is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Tuesday, July 30th, 2019. I'm Buster Olney. I'm actually down at the Get Up Studios down in Seaport, down in the city, and Troy Farkas is back in Bristol. Troy, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. It's so nice to hear you speak so clearly. This is music to a producer's ears.
It does sound better. You're telling me the sound is better.
Oh, you sound amazing. Best I've ever heard you.
Well, okay, cool. I'll have to remember that. Moving forward, and obviously today, a lot of talk about trades. There's a lot of stuff going on, a lot of things percolating. General managers are telling me they do think that although it's been slow, that there's going to be a rash of deals. And we did have a couple deals on Monday. The Phillies acquired Jason Vargas from the Mets. It seems like a proportional response for where the Phillies are, where they're not the top of the National League East, but they do add some help at the back end of their rotation. The Mets received minor league catcher Austin Bassart. The Brewers acquired pitcher Jordan Lyles from the Pirates. The Nationals placed Max Scherzer on the 10-day injured list. Here's Eduardo Perez on SportsCenter last night with Kevin DeGondi. And, of course, Eduardo was actually doing the Nationals game last night. So, remember, he's been around the Nationals team the last 24 hours.
One of the reasons that they put him on the IL was to pretty much protect him from himself. This is a guy that wants to take the ball. He understands how important it is to take the ball every fifth day. Now you put him on the IL, you allow him to get the bullpens and not put pressure of, I have to be out there on my normal start date. Listen, let the guys do what they do. If it's Corbin tonight, Sanchez, you go with Strasburg the way he's been pitching, he can get ready, get stronger as that lineup is complete. That's the most important part.
The Blue Jays face the Royals on Monday, and there's a lot going on around the Blue Jays. Of course, they're trading off veterans like Eric Sogard the other day, like Marcus Stroman. And on Sunday, they summoned Bo Bichette to the big leagues, and he had his first at-bat in the majors.
The 0-1, bounding ball towards the hole, past the dive of Dozier, and into left field. And in his first Major League plate appearance, Bo Bichette has his first Major League hit. High fives, hugs, the group assembled in support of Bo Bichette, rising out of their chairs, and Kansas City recognizes this moment for Bo Bichette.
And his dad, Dante, of course, the former Major Leaguer, he went crazy on that first hit. That call from Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Later on, another son of a former big leaguer, Kevin Biggio, got a big hit for the Blue Jays.
The 2-1 pitch and high in the air, deep right field. That one's going to be between the white lines, and that one is gone. Kevin Biggio goes deep onto the porch behind the right field wall. His eighth home run of the season. Biggio showing off in front of his buddies, Bichette and Guerrero.
After the game, Bo Bichette talked with Sportsnet about making his debut.
I think all Blue Jays fans had goosebumps. Bo Bichette, didn't take you long to pick up your first major league hit. What's going through your mind when you stepped into the box for the very first time?
Well, first, just try to enjoy it, but second, try to, you know, battle, have a good at bat, get a good pitch to hit, and put some bat speed on it. So it was awesome.
When you looked to your left and saw Kevin, and you looked to your right and saw Vladdy, how much did that help you feel a little bit more comfortable tonight?
I think it was definitely calming. I mean, the whole day I was jitters, anxious, and then I stepped on the field and it all went away. Yeah. Like, I didn't feel nervous or anything for the entire game at any point. So I think it definitely helped be able to look over and see Cav and Vladdy, and it kind of just felt normal. So having them helped me a lot.
And, of course, that group of young players will be playing together for a long time with the Blue Jays. That interview, by the way, was done by Hazel May. Earlier in the day, Ross Atkins was on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, talking about the process of trading Stroman.
Based on the conversations we had with, eight-plus teams to start, narrowing it down to four teams with, one or two on the periphery with the most interest, we felt like we had a very good understanding of what teams' willingness was to trade for Marcus Stroman. Every team has different valuations on prospects and how you project what that means and value for your future. And teams are doing a better and better job of understanding younger and younger players, and that's why you see the value in teams trying to keep prospects. And the trades for established major leaguers, for younger players, that the younger players seem to be really increasing in value. In the end, we had a very good understanding of how the teams that were interested in Marcus were valuing him. So that's how we made that determination. And it's so hard, especially for a player that's been in one organization and been so successful here. And I know that this city and country is very important to him. This organization was very important to him. So it was very emotional.
The Padres and the Orioles in San Diego, and the Padres got off to a great start in this game.
Fernando Tatis Jr. leading off, of course, and the first pitch of the night for Hess is hit in the air to deep left. Santander going back, looking up, there it goes! A leadoff home run for Fernando Tatis Jr. The first pitch that Hess threw, and the Padres take a 1-0 lead. He swings at the first pitch, deep to center field, Wilkerson looking up, back to back! Tatis and Reyes take the first two pitches of the night out over the fence. 2-0 San Diego. David Hess comes in with an ERA over 7. He had allowed 6 homers in his last 5 starts.
That sound from 97.3 The Fan in San Diego. San Diego wins this game 8-1. The Reds beat the Pirates 11-6 with help from Jose Iglesias.
Home with the 1-1. And Iglesias sends a fly. Deep right center field. On the run, Marte at the wall. He turns and looks. It is gone! Jose Iglesias with a grand slam. It is a 10-run Reds second inning.
That from 700 WLW. The Rockies and the Dodgers. This was a blowout. Colorado winning 9-1. And what was talked about the most after the game was something that happened with Jock Peterson of the Dodgers. He came to the plate with the Dodgers trailing 6-1 in the top of the 8th inning.
2 balls, 2 strikes the count. Now the pitch to Peterson. He swings, hits a ground ball to first. This will get a run in. As Murphy runs, steps on the bag. Peterson didn't even run to first. He went a few steps, stopped, turned around. Got the run in with a ground ball out.
That was Tim Nevert, AM 570 LA Sports. Yeah, Jock Peterson made it about a third of the way down to first base, and he stopped. And his manager, Dave Roberts, pulled him out of the game. He said after the game, there's a certain way to play the game, and I didn't see the effort there. Peterson called his own base running unprofessional. Here's more from Jock.
I think that, it was unprofessional and let the emotions get the best of me, and I need to, I'm better than that.
What's the most frustrating aspect of today for you?
There's no single out anything. It's a combination of things, but yeah.
The Marlins beat the Diamondbacks 11-6. Miguel Rojas had a hand in that.
Granderson held up, was going back to third.
4-0. The pitch to Miguel Rojas is hit high into the air to left. It is up, up and away. A home run for Miguel Rojas. Number 4 on the year. He's homered in 3 straight games. And the Marlins open this up in the second inning.
Dave Van Horn, 940 WINZ. And maybe this pushes the Diamondbacks even further to becoming sellers, which is what I'm hearing from other teams. The Tigers beat the Angels 7-2. Miguel Cabrera, future Hall of Famer, got a big hit.
Cabrera with a home run to center field and a low 90s fastball in the first inning off Berea. Fly ball to center and a ground ball his last 2 times. Ground ball here. Past a diving Simmons into left center. That's going to score 2. Mercer is in. Jones right behind him. Miguel Cabrera with a 2-run single.
That from 97.1 The Ticket, Dan Dickerson.
Deep center field.
The game.
It's gone!
Of the day.
Game of the day involved the two teams at the top of the National League East, the Washington Nationals and the Atlanta Braves. And after the Nationals took a 2-0 lead against Dallas Keuchel, the Braves struck back in the top of the 4th.
The 3-2. Fastball pull. Rendon diving play. Scrambles to his feet. Fires high. It gets away and a run is in. Great play by Rendon. He rushed his throw. Duvall beats it at first, and Atlanta gets a 2-out run in the 4th inning. It's a 2-1 game.
Chip Carey on the Braves television network. Atlanta would tie the game 2-2, but in the bottom of the 6th inning, Anthony Rendon put the game out of reach.
Here's the 2-0. Swing, a long drive. Left field. This is way, way back.
That from the Nationals Radio Network. The Nationals win 6-3. They're looking for bullpen help. The Braves are looking for starting pitching help and bullpen help. A lot of teams looking for a lot of things. Let's get to it. Bob Nightingale covers baseball for USA Today. He's all over the trade deadline rumors. Bob, how you doing today?
Yeah, doing great. Best of things.
All right, so as you and I talk, we have approximately 30 hours to go. And there's no doubt to me that if you were to try to pick one team that's in the center of a lot of the stuff that's going to happen between now and the deadline, it's the Mets, who injected themselves in a way that I don't think anybody expects, or a lot of people don't actually understand, when they traded for Marcus Stroman the other day. We talked a lot on the podcast yesterday about the strategy behind it and whether or not it's sound. The fact is that they're trying to put themselves in a better position for 2020. And that means, and based on what I've heard around baseball, they're probably going to trade Edwin Diaz, their closer. They're probably going to trade Noah Syndergaard. And they're almost certainly going to trade Zach Wheeler, who's a free agent at year's end. Those trains seem to be going down those tracks. What are you hearing?
Yeah, I think they got to trade Wheeler, being a free agent. Sounds like they're not going to re-sign him anyway. So move him. Syndergaard, I think they just, you know, by getting Stroman, now they're cornering the market. So they can control what they get. So they either trade him now, trade him this winter, you know, trade him next July to trade deadline. But I agree with you. I think he is gone. There's something amiss between him and the front office, where I'm not saying there's an urgency to deal him, but you know, I think they'd like to move him. And Diaz, we'll see. You know, if the I think it's embarrassing for them to move Diaz, just because of what they had to give up to get him in the first place, plus taking all the money on Cano's contract. But if they can get something comparable, why not?
Yeah, and just to double back on this, I'll tell you what I've heard. Other teams, while a lot of teams are talking about a possible combination of guys, a Diaz and a Wheeler, and you know the Braves have been involved in some of those. The Tampa Bay Rays have been involved with some of those, and we'll double back on them. You know, I've had people with other teams think that in the end, because the Astros are not willing to give up Kyle Tucker in a bigger deal for Noah Syndergaard, that Zach Wheeler might fit Houston. What do you hear about the Astros and maybe Wheeler?
Yeah, I heard that from two GMs early in the day yesterday, and then one late last night, that everybody's predicting Wheeler to the Astros. Just like you said, they don't want to give up the prize prospects, and that's a perfect fit for him, a rental. You remember now, I mean, they didn't even want to give up prospects for Justin Verlander a couple of years ago. And that was pushed on him by A.J. Hinch, and they still forced the Tigers to eat some of that salary. The trade was so ridiculous. But, yeah, Wheeler makes the most sense to them. Makes more sense than a Robbie Ray, who I think would be in the picture too, because I think they feel that, yeah, they can make Robbie Ray a better pitcher, you know, just like they have with Garrett Cole, Verlander, and now Wade Miley.
You mentioned about Syndergaard, you know, the issue and the tensions that exist between he and the leadership of that team. It's amazing to me how widely known that is. That's not a secret, and that's part of the why I think a lot of baseball executives believe that the Mets are going to trade Syndergaard before the deadline. Perhaps the team like the Padres, who on paper to me make the most sense because they've got a wide range of players to choose from.
Yeah, and I talked to Padres the last couple of days, and right now they're very pessimistic at trade what happened. They said the asking price is way too steep, and they're well aware of the same things going on with Syndergaard in the front office too, which makes them wary. Say, well, you know, what happens here? So, but when you talk to the Mets, they say there's no urgency to trade Syndergaard. They're not denying there's a little bit of a rift, but they're also not saying, hey, we have to trade him right now. They can certainly trade him in the off season, where more clubs would be equipped to take him on and everything else.
Now, about Edwin Diaz, it's been interesting to me, again, like with Syndergaard, you hear from other teams like, yeah, they're going to move him. That's the perception of the momentum, that he's readily available right now. It might be because his salary is going to increase by about 1,400% next year when he goes through arbitration for the first time. And the teams that I'm hearing, the Dodgers, as we know, have a very narrow focus on adding a high-end reliever, and Edwin Diaz would certainly fit that. He would be a guy, he'd go over the Dodgers, he wouldn't have to pitch with much pressure. He would be a nice safety net for Kenley Jansen, assuming that the Dodgers would help to, you know, build on what he's done lately and pitching better. I've heard the Tampa Bay Rays are being very aggressive. The last couple weeks, general managers with other teams are telling me, watch the Rays, even if they're not necessarily as close to the top of the American League East as they have been in the past. They're looking for long-term solutions, and because Diaz is still making close to minimum wage, he could fit for them. You know, Wheeler would be someone who could help out if they put those two guys in a package, who could help out for this year and help them make the playoffs. The most interesting team, and I talked about this yesterday, to me, are the Boston Red Sox, because they clearly have a need in the bullpen. Edwin Diaz would absolutely fit in terms of helping with that, but also with the payroll issue, because the ownership of the Red Sox doesn't want to take on a lot of payroll. They're bumping up against the payroll threshold, and Diaz isn't making any money this year. He doesn't go to arbitration for the first time until the winter time. So he'd fit in that regard. And you know, Alex Cora knows Diaz. You know, they're both from Puerto Rico. He put Diaz on the WBC team. He absolutely loves that kid. The two sides have talked. And as I mentioned, the Mets' focus is on adding pieces to help them win in 2020. And I suspect that, you know, this is why the Red Sox are now in a position where they need to decide whether or not to put an Andrew Benintendi, maybe a Jackie Bradley Jr. in this deal. Those guys would be able to fill the Mets' hole in center field. And you know what? I think you can make an interesting argument on both sides of a Benintendi for Diaz swap, because the players are both really young and they're comparable in service time. That to me is an interesting one to watch, because I think if the Red Sox trade for Diaz, their chances of repeating as World Series champions would jump by a large percentage. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm the Mets, I would jump all over a Benintendi package. You know, Bradley, you think twice. The only thing that would worry me, Buster, about Edwin Diaz is, hey, this guy, as we all know, pitched lights out in Seattle. Absolutely zero pressure. The team loses year after year, small crowds, absolutely no pressure. Now he goes to New York, and we see what's happening. He's not the same guy. So if he's struggling in New York, what in the world is going to happen in Boston? You know, maybe something they can fix, or maybe the pressure is too much. You know, where a Tampa would make sense. And I agree with you, in L.A., even though it's the number, you know, two market in America, you know, night and day between that and New York in Boston. So that would be my only worry with the Red Sox. Can this guy handle pitching at Fenway Park in a moment Bennett range? It's just such a different animal, you know, pitching the AL East, let alone Boston.
Let's spin off on the Dodgers. Diaz, one of the relievers they're looking at, from what I understand in their conversations with the Pirates about Felipe Vasquez, the Pirates are saying, if you want Vasquez, you got to put Gavin Lux, who's the Dodgers' top prospect, in the deal. And the Dodgers are saying, we're not going to trade Gavin Lux. And so the last I heard, those two sides were at an impasse. They've talked in the past about Brad Hand, but it's a very small list that they're working from, Bob, it seems like, in terms of possible relief targets.
Yeah, I don't know what happened to Kirby Yates. You know, let teams know he was available. I would jump over at Yates. I'm not sure the Padres could trade Yates to the Dodgers. You know, with the rivalry and the fans probably going ballistic in San Diego if that happens. But yeah, you know, the Dodgers, they've always held on to their top prospects, and they made some big moves over the years with Manny Machado and getting Yu Darvish. But now I think they're the best Dodger team in 30 years, and they need to get a reliever, or they're going to have the same problem again in October. So, you know, maybe they'll give up Gavin Lux, but they give up some other prize guys. And they're so loaded in the farm system. And they do such a great job scouting and developing. You know, if you're the Dodgers, you might think, you know what, we'll go get some more prospects. I mean, we have that much faith in our scouting in the farm system that we can make this work. And Diaz is a long-term guy. But they got to get somebody if they're going to win the World Series. I'd be completely shocked if Wednesday afternoon rolls around and we don't see another closer, co-closer in that Dodger bullpen.
And I feel the same way about the Yankees, that if they're going to, and they have a terrific team, but if they're going to win the World Series, they need to bolster that rotation, to give them a better chance to match up a Verlander, a Garrett Cole in the postseason. I said on air the other night that I thought that Brian Cashman, the Yankees general manager, is under more pressure than any executive in baseball right now, because no longer can you defer these conversations and these decisions to August. You got to make a deal before 4 o'clock on Wednesday. I still think that there's a chance that they're going to land Trevor Bauer. I think they love his stuff as a horse. He's absolutely what they're looking for, but we know the Indians are going to ask a really high price. Robbie Ray of the Diamondbacks, we've talked about, maybe Mike Minor. I, if I'm sitting here today and I had to guess one way or the other, I think they wind up with either Bauer or Robbie Ray. What about you?
I mean, Bauer makes a lot more sense to him, already pitching the American League. You know, he can pitch under pressure and everything else. Robbie Ray, fantastic arm. The only thing that scares you about Robbie Ray is, you know, every start's about the same, you know, five innings, 10, 11 strikeouts, a few walks. Now, he's reduced his walks of late, But if he's doing that in the National League West, what in the world's going to happen in the AL East? You know, you need some innings out there. I heard the Yankees now, you know, could pivot and go get some more relievers, almost do a bullpen by committee come October, you know, which could work. But you're right, they got to do something because right now there's a great regular season team, but you don't like your chances at all in October unless they get that pitching help. So, and I think if they get Bauer, I think what they would do is at least canvas that clubhouse, especially particularly the veterans, and say, you okay with this, with Bauer, just with his personality quirks and everything else. And they got such a great clubhouse, they got to make sure it's a fit too.
And I asked, we had the Yankees and Red Sox on Sunday Night Baseball, and I just mentioned Bauer's name, and I didn't even ask the question about whether or not Bauer and the clubhouse. And the response when I mentioned Bauer, because that was the day, of course, he threw the ball over center field, and the guy looked at me, and I think you might be able to guess, Bob, but we're not going to say his name, who the person said this to me was. He looked at me, he said, our clubhouse is titanium. There's no, and his, from his perspective, like they can't even, it won't affect their clubhouse culture. Bauer will be welcome with open arms. It's a very tolerant group. CC Sabathia and Aaron Judge and, you know, great people in that clubhouse. And, you know, I said yesterday, I thought Trevor in the, I mean, what he did was something that just clearly unacceptable to his Hall of Fame manager, Terry Francona. But I thought afterward, I thought he handled it perfectly.
No, he did handle it probably afterward, but he had no choice. I mean, we saw Francona, you know, I'm surprised Francona didn't body slam on the mound. He was so furious. So it's no secret they would like to get rid of him. That's where they shopped him all winter. And, you know they're not getting rid of him because of his money or anything like that. It's more personality. And, hey, he's not pitching that well. I do think he'd pitch a lot better somewhere else. But I don't think they're going to get enough from him right now. But I think it's more personality than anything. It was just in the clubhouse in Francona, just the urgency there. But they have to get something in return. You can't say, well, we got rid of this guy, but we just cost ourselves a playoff berth. They can't afford to take that risk. But if Bauer was pitching like he did last year, then I think no question at all, he's staying put.
And you led me right in perfectly into my next question. You know, the two great buy-sell questions as we get close to the deadline, the Indians and the Giants. And the Indians with Bauer. And I checked around about this yesterday, and basically what I hear is that the Indians are still talking with other teams. I know they're two games out in their division, and their chances for making the playoffs are at 75%. But with Corey Kluber coming back, the Indians are still talking about Bauer with other teams. And I thought about this too, Bob, is that at some point, if they wanted to, if they trade Bauer and they still feel like the Kluber is a ways away in making his return, you could go trade for a Tanner Roark to plug the hole at the back end of the rotation for a little bit while cashing in on the value of Bauer in a trade. And with Madison Bumgarner, it's a similar situation. Although the Giants now 2.5 games out in the wild card, their chance of making the playoffs stand at 8% according to FanGraphs, but I hear that there's a lot of momentum to keep Madison Bumgarner, and yet they are taking phone calls, and they are making phone calls for the preparing for the possibility that they wind up selling.
Yeah, you know, when I was in San Francisco last week, they had a buzz in that ballpark, Buster, that they haven't heard in a couple of years. Fans were excited. TV ratings were down 35% the first half in San Francisco for the Giants games. Attendance down, I want to say 8,000 a game. All of a sudden, people are excited again. You know, realistically, it is a little bit of a long shot for them to make the playoffs, certainly not go deep. But I think Bumgarner has meant so much to that organization. So, you know, and the players would just, you know, go bonkers if they made a move now and trade guys away. We almost have to. And, you know, let's be honest, what the Mets had to give up for Marcus Stroman, the Giants have to sit back and say, man, if that's all they got for Stroman, are we going to get a huge package for Baumgartner? So they'd have to be blown away, I think, to move him now. And just kind of go for this thing and then say, you know what, it's been a great ride. You know, we got the qualifying offer on you, so at least we'll get something back. And I do think Cleveland is a the trouble with Kluber is you sort of know which Kluber you're going to get. I mean, Kluber was struggling before he got hurt, too. He's had his postseason struggles. So, you know, we'll see. It could be a dangerous team in the playoffs, but I can't see them just trading Bauer just and dump him and get a guy like Roark. I do like Roark, but, you know, he's only just a back-end starter, not a front-line guy.
No. Yeah, he would just basically be a placeholder that would allow you to deal Bauer to another team. And real quick on the Giants, I've thought about this with Farhan Zaidi, the head of baseball ops, in his first year with the Giants. If I were a professional colleague, you know, a friend of his, where, you know, I worked in the same front office, I'd say, Farhan, you can trade Bumgarner and probably get some value, but think about the reaction among Giants fans and the perception that you would be creating about yourself if you pull the rug out from underneath this team the way that it's playing, you know, and he would have to swim upstream against that in the years to come. And so if the rebuilding process was a little bit slow or 2 or 3 or 4 years, you don't want to get tagged in the media and you don't want to get tagged by your fans as a guy who quit on 2019. And that, it's not worth it to me, as you said, considering the return that you're probably going to get for Bumgarner.
No, absolutely, Buster. I mean, one thing, if they were just kind of mulling around 500, but to have this kind of shrink, you know, whatever, 18 or 23, 24, to get themselves to this point, be very, very tough on the new guy in the block. It was Brian Sabian. Hey, no problem at all. Sabian won 3 World Series in 5 years. Fans would say, well, you know, this guy's a genius, so we trust him. He's got Flagg going to the Hall of Fame as executive. So, but having a new guy for the Dodgers, he'd be very tough PR-wise, and I think it would really turn off a fan base. I mean, people in Chicago still talk about the 97 white flag team with the White Sox, and that team was going nowhere. So this would be like the whitest of white flag trades. I just don't see how they can do it.
30 hours to go before the deadline, Bob. That's when you get some sleep. Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure as always. Thank you, Buster.
Let's listen to Marcus Stroman in his introductory conference call with reporters on Monday from MLB.com.
Definitely was expecting to get moved to some team at some point, obviously, before the deadline, just because of all the rumors. So hearing it was the Mets, it was shocked. And then obviously knowing that it was New York was kind of followed by a level of excitement as well, because ton of my family, ton of my friends are Met fans, and obviously coming home is huge. So yeah, I'm excited to be a New York Met, and I can't wait to get there and kind of be a part of it. I think it's an unbelievable team. Like you said, I truly think it's one of the best staffs in all baseball. I mean, I think DeGrom's the best in the game right now. Some Syndergaard is one of the best power arms in baseball. Mets when he's on, obviously, you just saw a CG shutty the other day. Vargas is another guy who can deal as well, so I think there's so many guys in the rotation who can shut down any team at some point, and I feel like I'm capable of doing the same. So you throw that along with the lineup that we have, the young guys that have been raking, obviously McNeil, obviously Conforto, obviously Alonso's been doing crazy, crazy things, man. So I'm just excited to join up with these guys and just be a part of it and just to kind of add to it. My energy is extremely authentic, man. I love playing the game of baseball. I love competing. When I'm between those lines, it's kind of a different savage, a different demon that kind of is out there. I kind of go to a dark place to kind of put myself where I need to be, and I'm very passionate, I'm very emotional. But away from the field, I'm very relaxed, and I'm kind of the opposite. So I'm excited. My energy rubs off on some of the guys. That'll be amazing. But like I said, I think they have a pretty good grasp on things. They're very close to kind of being in contention, and I hope that I can just add to what they have and kind of be a spark. And like I said, hopefully we can rattle off some wins here and make it interesting.
Before we get with Hembo, we all have credit card bills. Every month we get them with multiple payments and multiple due dates. Wouldn't it be easier to have just one payment at a lower rate? Well, you can with a credit card consolidation loan from my friends at Lightstream. Get a rate as low as 5.95% APR with AutoPay, lower than the average credit card interest rate of over 19% APR. Plus, the rate is fixed, so it will never go up over the life of the loan. The online application is so easy, you can apply right from your phone. Just for my listeners, apply now to get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/BBTN. That's LIGHTSTREAM.com/BBTN.
And this is subject to credit approval. Rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice.
Jumping into the numbers.
After evaluating millions of pieces of data in the blink of an eye, the winner is Cincinnati by 200 points. Why, you worthless hunk of junk.
This is Hembo knows.
And Hembo, of course, is Paul Embiakides, a bigwig on the show Get Up. And in fact, I'm seeing you face to face for the first time in doing one of these because I'm on the show Get Up only because you let me in the building. I appreciate that.
Well, so this is like an online dating exercise. Like you're like the girl that I've talked to for 3 years on the dating app, and we're seeing each other in the flesh just so I know that I'm not being catfished. But I'm a lot less impressive in person, I've been told many times.
Well, I mean, and that's a given with me, no doubt about it. All right, so I want you to weigh in before we get to your listed topics. I want you to weigh in what everybody in the industry is talking about, the strategy of the Mets to win now. They tried to win now in 2019. They paid a lot for that. It obviously didn't pay off. And now with all these moves making, all these parts that are in play, they're trying to win now in 2020. What do you think?
Well, I mean, strategy might be a strong way of putting it. I mean, you could also say they're playing darts blindfolded. The way that the Mets are, they're behaving like the Yankees used to. And conversely, the Yankees are behaving like the Mets should. It's a very odd irresponsibility on their behalf. I haven't talked to a single person in the industry that is sort of backs up the strategy, as you put it, as to what they're doing, because there's no real line of threat of commonality between the moves. I think that's exceedingly obvious. Perhaps Brody has some sort of grand plan here, but the sense that I get is that they're almost doing this thing day to day, and that's a really messy way to build an organization.
And I mentioned with the podcast that I am concerned about all these moves where they're sort of hemorrhaging value with a series of moves. That the franchise is essentially slowly being driven into the ground, which, as you remember, you mentioned the Yankees, and I think it's a great comparison. The Yankees in the early 80s under George Steinbrenner, they slowly went into the ground to the point where George just threw up his hands and said, forget it, I'm out. And he turned the team over to Gene Michael, and it took them years to rebuild from that. But there's one huge difference between what George Steinbrenner did in the mid-80s and the way that he ran the team and the way the Mets do it is the Mets don't spend money like the Yankees did.
They're not willing to spend money in the same way. When you consider how much control of young players they're conceding for present-day value in players that they're not even really getting that much present-day value for, they've just done really bad math. And now it seems like they're doubling down on their original bad decision, and that's the worst thing that you can possibly do as a front office.
All right, let's talk about the starting pitching market.
It's occurred to me that the frontline starting pitchers aren't really fetching what they used to at the trade deadline, and perhaps that's because they've become devalued in the postseason. Buster, last season, relievers accounted for nearly 50% of all postseason innings, and that number has steadily increased by 10% since 2015. Further, only one starter has topped 100 pitches in a World Series game over the last 2 years, and for good reason. During that time, Buster, starters have allowed an OPS north of 1,000 when facing a hitter for the third time in a ballgame.
Wow. There's no doubt about it. I think the teams now, if they had a choice between the two, do we make the rotation great or do we make the bullpen great? They'd rather have the bullpen great going into the postseason. I guess, case in point, the New York Yankees right now.
No kidding. And to be clear, though, you can move your starters to the bullpen and sort of shorten
David
the game.
Price, Nathan Eovaldi, all those
Sale,
guys with the Red Sox last year.
We've seen Sale and Scherzer do that somewhat unsuccessfully in the last few years. But to be clear, like you're facing an order for the twice through, and that's about it for almost every pitcher in baseball.
All right, let's talk about the Nationals pitching. I feel like that they're, in these last hours, one of the teams under the most pressure because of that hole at the back end of the bullpen and so many other good parts with this team.
Yeah, speaking of starting pitching not mattering, the Nationals might have the three best ones in the National League right now. In fact, Max Scherzer, Steven Strasburg, and Patrick Corbin have started 20 games since the middle of June, June 16th to be exact. That trio is 15-0 during that time with a 1.79 ERA. They've allowed 5 home runs and 130 and 2/3 innings. The Nats as a team have won 18 of those 20 games. Now, obviously, Scherzer's going back on the injured list. We don't think that it's serious based on everything that I've read. But that group right now is as good as any trio in baseball by a long shot.
And you want to talk about the automatic strike zone, which for me feels like a fait accompli. And I can't tell you if it's going to be in 2020 or 2022 or 23, but it's coming.
It is an inevitability in my judgment as well, but there are two reasons why the technology is not close and I have the numbers to support it. First, breaking balls in the lower third have never been called the way that fastballs have. This season, Buster, 15% of those pitches that have been tracked in the strike zone haven't been called a strike. That's more than 1,200 pitches on the season. Secondly, fastballs at the letters aren't called strikes at a high rate either. In fact, 26% of fastballs in the upper third of the zone that have been in the strike zone have been called a ball. That's more than 2,700 pitchers. The moral of the story isn't that the technology is wrong or flawed. It's that the rulebook strike zone isn't and has never truly been enforced.
Before you go, I also want to get your opinion on an option that's out there, perhaps for the Red Sox and the Mets. One of the combinations that has been discussed, the Red Sox perhaps could trade Andrew Benintendi and get Edwin Diaz back in return. They're two players. They're both young. They're comparable in service time. The Red Sox have a loaded lineup, but they do have an issue at the back end of their bullpen. Benintendi could be the Mets center fielder, which is really his true position. And talk us through how you feel about both sides of that trade.
If I were GM of the Mets, I would do that in a heartbeat. If I were the GM of the Red Sox, I would not. I just have a very difficult time conceding that much control of a young, cost-controlled position player. There's a lot more certainty there. I know Edwin Diaz can shove. He's proven it. His ERA is sort of inflated this year for a variety of reasons. I don't expect that to be an issue long-term. He's a stud, and we know that. But in my judgment, it's actually easier to find a couple guys that can blow cheese at the back end of the bullpen than to find a guy that can give you 500 quality plate appearances in a season and produce three or four wins above replacement. Even if Andrew Benintendi doesn't quite reach his ceiling, he still provides a lot more value over the next 3 or 4 years than Diaz does, in my judgment.
And especially with Jackie Bradley Jr., Mookie Betts headed to free agency, I agree with you. But I'll ask you a different element to that question. Are the Red Sox better if in 2019 and have a better chance to win a second straight World Series if they make that trade? Because I think the answer is yes.
Probably so. And that's the challenging thing, because who knows where Dave Dombrowski is going to be in 3 or 4 years. He is a win-now GM, and he always has been. It would not at all surprise me if they pulled the trigger on that, but if you flip the roles, I could not justify clicking accept on that trade if I was managing the team.
All right, Embo. Well, good to see you.
You too, bud.
Steve Wilkerson is center fielder for the Baltimore Orioles, and he's also the first position player in the history of baseball to register a save. He did that in the 16th inning of an Orioles win over the Angels last week. And Stevie, congratulations on that. I was reading that you were contacted by the good folks at the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, it was, well, first of all, it was a crazy game. 16 innings back and forth. It took me a while to wrap my head around what actually happened after the game there. But when Jim came up to me and said that the Hall of Fame was wanting some kind of memorabilia from the game, I was like, you got to be kidding me, man. What's happening right now? So, it was pretty crazy and pretty special.
So what was your response when he mentioned that to you, that, you know, they were just hoping, because I know the folks at the Hall of Fame, and when they do these requests, it's, you know, if you can give us anything, what was your response?
Yeah, they asked what I'd be willing to give, whether it be the ball or the hat or the lineup card, and I said, yeah, they can have anything they want, man. It's Cooperstown, you know, they can take it all, and as long as they let me come check it out, they can have whatever they want.
Boy, that'll be absolutely cool for you in the future. And I got to tell you, the nature of your save and the way you went about it has absolutely started a conversation around baseball. I think as you demonstrated in front of the whole baseball world about how difficult it is for hitters to adjust to lower speeds. I was talking to Chris Sale in the Red Sox dugout on Saturday, and I mentioned this. He goes, are you kidding me? Like, you don't think we've all been talking about that? He said, you don't think next spring you're going to see pitchers throwing 52-mile-an-hour curveballs, just flipping it in there? And he talked about how, you know, that wasn't a good look for pitchers when you have a position player drop in. So I want to ask you about that. First off, what's your history in terms of pitching?
I actually have zero history in pitching. I threw one pitch in high school. And since then, I hadn't thrown a pitch off the mound until, 3 weeks ago in a slightly different fashion than the appearance I had a few days ago. But I have zero pitching background. I have zero approach on the mound besides just floating the ball over the plate and letting things play out. But that's really funny that Sale said that. And we've all been in the box facing position players, and, you know, it's never a comfortable at-bat. You know, no one really looks forward to those at-bats. So, you know, adjusting to the gravity ball is not the easiest thing to do when you've played, you know, 8-9 innings of facing 95. So I can't imagine that many people will be throwing 55-mile-an-hour floaters, but, if the pitcher was able to throw it for a strike and mix it in after throwing 95, I mean, hell, it wouldn't be easy. So I don't know, man.
So, as you know, just about all of your peers, when they were in high school or they were in college, at some point or another, they were pitchers. How come that wasn't something that you did?
Yeah, I don't know. I pitched when I was younger, like, a little league travel ball, stuff like that. Yeah, but in high school I never did. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, I never threw in high school. I don't know if I was saving my arm for football or or what it was, but I don't know. We had a pretty good staff there too. We had a couple good starters, you know, a few guys going to some big time colleges and stuff, and they didn't really need me, I guess. So I was never approached about pitching in high school.
So when you and all position players do this, been watching it for many years, when you warm up before games and you're playing catch, what's been your sideline repertoire, your warm-up repertoire when you're playing catch with a teammate?
You know, in typical fashion, I guess. You know, when they ask me the few times I've been asked to go warm up to pitch, I just go into the batting cage and get on the mound in the batting cage and throw the little circle behind the plate and try to hit it. But I don't really have a program or whatever it may be.
No. But I mean, I'm curious because, you know, when guys are playing catch, you'll say, hey, check out my knuckleball or check out my curveball on the side. Did you ever have something like that?
Gotcha. I got, you know, not really. I'm a fastball changeup guy, if you will. But apparently when I tried to throw my changeup the other day, it was 3 miles an hour faster than my fastball. So I don't really know what's going on up there.
So let me ask you though, did you, cause I mean, you can throw harder than 54 miles an hour, in a vacuum, I'm sure. Did you at some point, if you got these opportunities to pitch and this was your third one, did you sort of consciously make up your mind, you know what, I'm just gonna just absolutely float it up there rather than a lot of the position players you see, they'll mm-hmm. get excited, they'll get their adrenaline, they'll try to mm-hmm. throw, look, this is what I did back in high school. Mm-hmm. What was your thought process?
Yeah, the first time I went out there, I was just really trying not to make a mockery out of things and trying not to get hurt, really. And so I was just kind of floating it in there. And, you know, obviously I had a lot more in the tank, but that first outing, first of all, I didn't know what I was doing. And second of all, I was just trying to throw the ball over the plate and not get hurt. And it ended up working. I had a 1-2-3 inning, and then next time I went back out there and I was like, well, shoot, I might as well just do the same thing. And so I did it again and it worked again. And then this past time when there was a little bit on the line, I went with what had worked. So that's kind of how it came about. But really, I was just trying to throw the ball over the plate and get our team off the field. But there have been a few times when I've been on the mound and I've had some guys though too where I wanted to amp it up and see what I had in there, but I did the exact opposite and slowed it down even more. So I guess that's my pitching style, if you will.
And you inspired a conversation, a debate about what you were actually throwing. Like I was in our Sunday Night Baseball production meeting on Monday, and Alex Rodriguez said, yeah, he was throwing a curveball, right? And I'm like, no, I think he was throwing a nothing ball. Because of the loop, everyone assumed it was a curveball. So, for the record, what exactly were you throwing?
Yeah, I think it registers as a curveball because of the arc or whatever, but it's a fastball grip, and I kind of just flick it off the side, and it kind of lets gravity take it down, but it's a fastball grip, so I don't really know what to call the pitch.
So, one of the three batters that you retired is a guy, speaking of Cooperstown, who's going to be making a mm-hmm. speech there sometime in the next decade, in Albert Pujols. At any time during that at bat, does it cross your mind, my God, that guy in the box is one of the greatest hitters of all time, someone that I watched as a kid, and here I am pitching to him?
Yeah, that was actually the first time where I kind of felt a little, my heart skip a beat or whatever, but you know, it was a little bit different when, you know, I'm standing there on the mound and Albert Pujols is in the box and you know, there's two outs and we got a chance to win the game. Obviously a slightly different fashion than the last few appearances that I had, but going down the rap sheet of the guys that I faced and gotten out is actually kind of hilarious, but but that's the first time when I was like, man, this is our Pujols, and this is for the game, this is for the win, and this is pretty crazy.
So what was the coolest reaction? I thought that when you got the third out, you were pointing around like, like you'd had like 500 saves before in your lifetime. Like, we had this one. You know, was it like you were excited? What was the funniest reaction you got after that game?
I think when our skipper, when I got over to, you know, shake everyone's hand after the game and got over to the skipper and he just chest bumped me and we was cracking up. You know, that was probably the best reaction I got. But the whole clubhouse, I mean, like I said, the game was crazy, and for it to end that way, everyone's reaction was priceless, and the vibe in the clubhouse after the game was, you know, everybody was just cracking up and super excited for me and for the team, and it was really the reaction I've gotten from everyone, and then after that too, from family and friends and college coaches who are kicking themselves for jokingly not having me pitch. You know, it's been pretty funny.
Yeah, I was going to say, you probably didn't have a lot of text messages right when you got back to your locker, because it was so early, late at night at the end of, what, a 6-hour and 14-minute game.
Yeah,
so the next day, tell me about that tidal wave.
Yeah, I think I woke up to about 140 text messages and did my best to get back to everybody. But it was pretty crazy hearing from some of the people that I heard from. Of course, every pitcher I've ever played with texted me and jokingly asked me to teach them whatever that was I was doing out there. But and then all the other stuff that's happened to me, being able to talk to you and some of the other guys I've been able to talk to, and you know, some of the whole Cooperstown deal. I mean, it's been a pretty crazy week, and I still haven't had wrapped my head around it, I don't think.
So tell me how you found out that you were the first position player to get a save in big league history. How did you actually learn that?
Yeah, we had a little team powwow after the game, and Hyder said that I was, at the time he said that I was the first position player to get a save since 1969, but I guess that's when the stat became official. So then shortly thereafter we found out that I was the first one ever. So I'm not sure how he got a hold of the information, but he was the one that told me, you know, shortly thereafter the game.
All right, Steve. Well, I appreciate your time, and I guarantee, you know, next spring when some pitcher flips a ball up to you at 52 miles an hour, you'll know why. And I fully expect to see this moving forward. You know, all position players, rather than try to ramp it up, they're going to dial it back.
I would sure get a kick out of that if someone did that next spring.
Bleacher Tweets.
Okay, Buster, we got some Bleacher Tweets for you here on the day before the trade deadline. Kevin Larkin at KLark24 wants to know, hey, Buster and Troy, how long before the Mets cut ties with the disaster of a decision it was to hire Brody Van Wagenen? The Wilpons didn't need help making bad decisions, but this is a disaster.
Look, I was on record last fall when they hired him. I didn't think it was a good hire because Brody just doesn't have experience in that job, but that's their guy, and there's no end in sight, and they are plowing ahead full steam. Jeff Wilpon has a lot of confidence in him.
Same team, Max A. Leibowitz at Max Leibowitz. Hey, guys, how many starts do you think Marcus Stroman will make for the Mets? Did they acquire him to flip him or to play him?
No, they're not going to flip him. They're keeping him for themselves to make themselves better in 2020. And because I think that this series of trades is a disaster for the Mets and they will be out of contention next year, I think we're going to be talking about Marcus Stroman perhaps being traded next year. So I'm going to say 30 starts.
Mark Sherman at Shark Merman. Hey, Buster, which team does a relatively quiet trade deadline benefit the most? My gut would tell me the more complete teams like the Astros and Dodgers, but possibly some of the bubble teams benefit as well.
Boy, would benefit from, or I think maybe a better way to put it would be not to be hurt by doing something. You know, the Indians would go in that category. If they hung on to Trevor Bauer, I think that absolutely, you could understand the logic behind it. And it would make them a more dangerous team as they're currently comprised for the postseason. Yeah, and I think the Giants, look, I think in the end they're going to wind up hanging on to Bumgarner. We'll just have to wait and see. But it makes sense in terms of their relationship with their fans that they would keep Bumgarner to ride out this year for Bruce Bochy.
And the Rangers, of course, have to hang on.
Yeah, I think, did it say contender, you know, complete teams, bubble teams, or do you really think they're on the bubble?
The Rangers, if they complete minor, they will have a major surge post-trade deadline.
Wow.
Mark my words, Buster. Charlie Two Bags at Charlie Two Bags. Hey, Buster, you said recently that the Nationals front office keeps their intentions under wraps the most. But have you heard anything about a deal for a reliever or maybe a start considering Scherzer's health? What's the word?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question, Charlie, that they will wind up trading for at least one reliever, probably two, and they'll get a left-handed reliever.
Last week's tweet this morning comes from Kevin Welch at KMWelch12. So many teams sending scouts to games in preparation for potential trades. What are these scouts looking for that they don't already know or you can't see in game footage?
Yeah, we were talking about how the industry is aware of the tension between Syndergaard and the front office. That's part of what the scouts do. You know, they go to the ballpark, they talk with people, they gossip. We're all paid gossips in this industry, let's face it. They find out things. I think they poke around about, hey, is this guy healthy? Has he been able to make his bullpen sessions? You know, there's some teams, the Astros at the front of this, are increasing, are relying more and more on video in terms of scouting, but there are definitely some teams that like to have boots on the ground to ask questions about makeup and health that they can't really know from video.
Love the tweets this morning. Tweet at me, Troy_Farkas. Tweet at Buster and give us your questions. Also, Buster, we're doing a special trade deadline show after the trade deadline hits tomorrow. I'm really excited for that.
Yeah, and so what we're going to do on Wednesday morning with all these balls in play, we're going to do a podcast, but obviously it would be kind of silly to speculate in our taping at 9 o'clock. Hey, what do you think is going to happen by 4 o'clock? So we'll do more of a straight type podcast in terms of baseball type stuff and talk about trades that have been made. And then after the deadline, Troy and I are going to get together up in Bristol. And I think, we'll have a couple other folks with us. They'll join us and we'll talk about the trade deadline and all the moves that are made. And that'll be posted, probably sometime around 6:30, 7 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon.
Gosh, I know, Buster. You're going to keep me up just before my bedtime. You're going to keep me here later than I need to be.
That's past your bedtime, 7 o'clock.
Can't wait.
All right. That's it for today. My thanks to Stevie Wilkerson, to Paul Hembekides, to Bob Nightingale, and to Troy Farkas, who produces podcast every day. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Enjoy all the trade talk.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.